Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.
Shrink Wrap Radio number 272, The Happiness Trap with Russ Harris, MD. Welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio, the planet's premier psychology podcast. This is your host, Dr. Dave, coming to you from the San Francisco Bay Area. Shrink Wrap Radio is the show that speaks from the psychologist in me to the psychologist in you, whether you be amateur, student, or professional. The U.S. Bill of Rights guarantees its citizens the pursuit of happiness. But is it possible that that pursuit can become the chasing after an illusory, unrealistic goal, like the hamster on its treadmill, a kind of trap, if you will? Well, that's the assertion of today's guest, Dr. Russ Harris, author of The Happiness Trap, How to Stop Struggling and Start Living. Let's go right to the interview. Dr. Russ Harris, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Well, I'm really happy to have this opportunity to meet with you and to discuss your work. You've gone from general practice physician to psychotherapist and executive coach. What triggered that transition in your life?
Well, I started working as a GP that I was very interested in the psychological aspects of health and well-being, which certainly wasn't something that we learned much about at medical school. And as a GP, you're always dealing with kind of stress. I mean, even the common cold is more likely when you're run down or stressed, and kind of the emotional and psychological aspects of illness are often neglected by GPs simply because it's quite time consuming.
Yeah, so you were really interested in psychology and the inner life and so on when you first went into medicine. Tell us a bit more about your evolution.
Yeah, sure. It was basically I was working as a GP in the early 90s, and there was a kind of hot new area of medicine at that time called psychoneuroimmunology, researched the connection between the mind and the body and the immune system and the nervous system, and really confirmed what Eastern philosophy has been telling us for thousands of years, that there's no real kind of separation between mind and body. But this was the kind of Western medicine acknowledging this and kind of finding this out through hard research.
Yes, exactly.
So I was very interested in all of that. And I found that my consultations started getting longer and longer and longer. You know, I'd be spending 25 minutes talking to people about their feelings and their stress, and then 5 minutes focusing on, you know, writing a prescription at the end. I started to realize that, you know, my interest just lay in the psychological side and not the physical.
Yeah, something had to change.
Yeah, exactly. So I basically started, you know, training in I thought, you know, how can I help people more deal with their kind of stress and their anxiety, and started training in counseling and therapy. The first model I ever trained in was CBT, cognitive behavioral therapy.
Right, and I understand that CBT, which is certainly dominant in this country, is also very dominant in Australia, where you are.
Yeah, it's kind of really dominant in most Western countries, certainly the English-speaking ones. CBT is huge in Australia. And you know, that was very interesting for me, but there was a particular part of CBT that never really gelled with me, which was the kind of challenging and disputing of negative thoughts.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, I became very interested in mindfulness meditation. Do you know the work of Jon Kabat-Zinn?
Yes, I do, and I have not been able to grab him for an interview. I haven't found a way to contact him, but I certainly have interviewed a number of people who were influenced by him and done interviews on mindfulness. But go ahead, tell us about your journey with it.
So, as you know, then John Kabat-Zinn is kind of the scientist that really introduced mindfulness to the Western world and started scientifically looking at the benefits of mindfulness meditation. And I was very interested in this too. So, for many years, I was being pulled between two horses running in two opposite directions. On the one hand, you know, here was the CBT stuff that had lots of very powerful interventions to help people change their behavior, but place this emphasis on trying to get into debates with your negative thoughts and challenge them and replace them, which just really didn't resonate with me on a personal level. And then you had this mindfulness stuff, which was the very opposite approach. Instead of getting into a debate or fighting with your thoughts, you just learn to step back and let them come and go, and, you know, just let them float past like leaves on a stream or cars driving past outside your house. And so I was struggling for a long time to try and find a way of bringing these two approaches together, and constantly exploring. And then back in 2003, I discovered the work of Stephen Hayes, I believe you've interviewed.
Yes, I have. And before you go into his work, let me just say that one of my listeners alerted me to your book, which is provocatively titled The Happiness Trap. And this particularly caught my attention because for some time I've been tracking developments in the relatively new field known as positive psychology, which is more or less about exploring the conditions that lead to happiness. So at first blush, your title would seem to fly in the face of that enterprise. So what do you mean by the happiness trap? I mean, the trap of happiness? Isn't that what we all want?
Well, the trap is that people misunderstand, or there are kind of lots of misleading ideas about happiness. The most common one being that happiness is the same as feeling good. And you know, ask most people what happiness is, they'll say it's a good feeling. You know, the most famous dictionary in Australia is called the Macquarie Dictionary, and it defines happiness as a state of pleasure or contentment. Mm. So, you know, if you think of the happiest day of your life, how long did a state of pleasure or contentment last before there was some frustration or anxiety or irritation? If that's your definition of happiness, that it's kind of a good feeling, there's no such thing as lasting happiness. And the problem is that lots of people assume that the formula for happiness is to get control of your feelings, cultivate the good ones, and eliminate the bad ones. And unfortunately, a lot of the positive psychology movement is reinforcing that that very notion. Mm. For example, feelings such as fear and sadness are often described as negative emotions. But, you know, they are very, very important emotions. You would be in a lot of trouble if you couldn't experience fear or if you couldn't experience sadness. They play a big role in creating a rich and meaningful life. However, many in positive psychology movement would describe them as negative, which kind of just conveys the idea that these things are in some way bad and we need to try and control them or eliminate them.
What are some of the other myths about how we achieve happiness or surrounding the idea of happiness?
Well, another one is the idea that, you've got to get control of your thoughts, replace all your negative thoughts with positive thoughts. I mean, positive thinking is huge in Australia. I assume it is in America too, right?
Oh, yeah.
You know, it's like it's everywhere. Even one of our most popular brands of bottled drinking water here now even has it on the label. It says, you know, drink positive, think positive. It's like, oh, no, I can't even have a sip of water without being told that I've got to, you know, think positively. And, of course, some of these kind of approaches go to extremes, like, you know, this book, The Secret, that tells you that your thoughts will manifest in reality, so you mustn't have negative thoughts, so they'll kind of, you know. So this idea out there that positive thinking is the answer to everything and that you should get control of your thoughts and challenge and eliminate your negative thoughts, which is just totally unrealistic because the human mind has evolved to think negatively. you know, 100,000 years ago, if there was a caveman that just went round always kind of thinking positively and optimistically, oh, you know, that rustling in the bushes, that's just a bird. Oh, you know, then he got eaten pretty quickly. It, you know, we didn't evolve from that caveman. We evolved from the caveman who was looking around for danger, anticipating the worst, thinking about all the things that could go wrong. That's the one we evolved from. So you've got this mind that's evolved to think negatively. And, you know, if you look at the Zen tradition, the you know, Zen masters are like the Olympic athletes of mind training. They have got highly trained mind, and yet even Zen masters, there's a tale, a teaching tale I love from the Zen tradition, where the monk goes to the abbot and says, "How can I find the greatest Zen master in the land?" And the abbot says, "Find the man who tells you he has eliminated all negative thoughts. And when you find this man, you know that's not him."
Yeah, that's a good one. That certainly supports your contention. Now, you started to mention before, I know that your therapeutic approach and your book are both inspired by the work of Professor Stephen C. Hayes at the University of Nevada, who I did have the opportunity to interview. And it's an approach that he calls ACT, or Action Commitment Therapy. I interviewed him back in, I think it was 2007, and I recall being very impressed by his approach. So I'm really glad that I remember one of the things I asked him was, well, are you training other people in this? I mean, this makes so much sense. I would hope that the word is getting out there. So it looks like the word has gotten out there in terms of you picking it up.
Oh, yeah. Look, I mean, when I read Steve Hayes' textbook on acceptance and commitment therapy, which the popular abbreviation is ACT rather than ACT. We kind of like to call it ACT.
Okay, I wasn't sure about that, so I'm glad you're setting me straight.
Well, because at its core, it's about action. It's you know, the aim of ACT is to kind of take mindful, values guided action. Clarify your values. What do you want to stand for? What sort of human do you want to be? When you look back from your deathbed at the life you lived, what do you want to say about the sort of person you were and what you did with your life and the role you played in the most important relationships? So this kind of big emphasis on clarifying your values and taking values-guided action. And it's also about mindful action, action which is done kind of consciously, intentionally, purposefully, open to your experience, engaged 100% in what you're doing in the present moment.
Well, that sounds like it was an ideal match for you, since you were already on the track of mindfulness, and that seems to be an important thread in the ACT approach.
Yeah, well, look, it was love at first sight. It kind of enabled me to take all the kind of good, solid behavioral change stuff from CBT, but to leave behind all the challenging and disputing of thoughts. And it enabled me to kind of take the mindfulness stuff, but without having to teach people meditation, which most people are not really into. ACT gives you lots of ways of learning kind of quick, simple mindfulness skills that really only take a couple of minutes. You know, meditation is a huge commitment, and only one way amongst literally thousands of learning mindfulness. So I think Steve Hayes did a great service in creating this this model of therapy.
Yes, well, let's drill down a little bit more deeply into it. In your book, you summarize the six core principles of ACT. I'm hoping you remember them and that you can take us through them.
Yeah, sure. Well, one of the key principles is contacting the present moment. You know, we tend to live inside our heads. We get all caught up inside our thoughts, and we tend to lose touch with what is actually happening right here, right now. You know, have you ever driven somewhere and not remembered the journey? Have you ever found yourself in a conversation with a loved one and you have suddenly realize you haven't heard a word they've been saying for the last couple of minutes?
Yes and yes. Yes to both.
You know, my wife says to me, "Where are you?" You know, "Oh, all right," you know, just kind of, you know, yanks me back into the present.
Right.
Kind of this learning to kind of stay in touch with the present moment, connect with the here and now, particularly notice what you can see and hear and touch and taste and smell, kind of engage with the world through the five senses rather than spending so much time caught up inside our heads. Obviously, you know, that's a factor that plays a big role in depression. People spend a lot of time caught up in their thoughts about, you know, doom and gloom and everything is, you know. And if we can teach people to kind of get out of their head and kind of come back and connect with the world around them, that makes a huge difference.
Certainly.
Another kind of mindfulness process is what we call diffusion. So if you think of two sheets of metal that are fused together, there's no separation. Diffusion means we start to separate or detach or get some distance from our thoughts. So, you know, your mind's telling you, you know, I'm not good enough, or I can't handle it, or I can't cope, or nobody likes me, or one of those sorts of stories that are very, very common that most of us carry around in our heads. You get caught up in that story, it has a huge impact and influence over you. But if you can learn to kind of take a step back from that story and see it for what it is, a bunch of words and pictures that pops into your head, then you can kind of reduce its impact and influence over you. In this approach, we never get into a debate over whether the story is true or false, as in CBT. We just kind of take a step back and notice the true nature, that what this actually is words popping up into my head. Whether they're true or false doesn't really matter. The question is, if I get all caught up in these words inside my head and I let them push me around and dictate what I do, will that help me to be the person I want to be? Will it help me to do the things I want to do?
Okay, that makes sense, yeah.
Yeah. So we've got lots of different ways of helping people develop this capacity for diffusion, to kind of separate or detach from their thoughts and see them as words and pictures. The third mindfulness skill in ACT is what we call acceptance, although I tend to use the word expansion rather than acceptance because people misunderstand the word acceptance. Many people think acceptance means liking it or wanting it or putting up with it or tolerating it or grinning and bearing it or just kind of gritting your teeth and, you know, white-knuckling it. And that's not what we mean at all. What we mean, you know, expansion is probably a better word. We teach people how to kind of create this expansive space inside them where they can open up and make room for difficult feelings and difficult emotions and difficult thoughts, and just kind of learn how to let those emotions and feelings flow through your body without getting pushed around by them, without getting held back by them, but also without getting into a fight or a struggle with them.
Right.
When you learn how to do this, there's no need to try to fight or control your feelings. You just learn how to let them come and go in their own good time. Massively reduces their impact and influence over you.
So far, this sounds a lot like meditation, what's taught in meditation, but I guess you've broken it down into bite-sized and very concrete steps.
Yeah, I think that's a great way of saying it. Yeah, absolutely. You know, so meditation is kind of thousands of years old, teaching people to do these things, but we can break these processes down into kind of simple, easy, practical skills that people can just learn in a few minutes. Because let's face it, you know, most people are just not willing to sit on a cushion and meditate on a daily basis. If they are, fantastic, but let's be realistic about it. It's a bit like going to the gym, you know, like, you know, most people go to the gym a little bit and then stop going.
Right.
Wouldn't gyms be in trouble if everyone with a membership actually turned up one day, you know? So meditation's the same sort of thing. Yoga, too. You know, if people are willing to do that stuff, or Tai Chi or martial arts, that's fantastic, but most people are not willing to do that.
Yes, I've done all of those things a little bit every now and then.
Exactly.
So I'm a good illustration of your point. I think we've gotten through about three of those six key concepts.
Yeah, so the fourth concept is something that calls the observing self. When we use the word mind, we're usually referring to thinking processes. When we talk about our mind is constantly thinking, imagining, planning, comparing, judging, remembering, fantasizing, etc. In ACT, we like to kind of point out that there are really two parts to the mind. There's the thinking self, the part that does all the thinking, but there's also this observing self, this part of us that kind of notices, that is aware, that is conscious, but doesn't actually think. It just kind of notices. It's responsible for awareness or consciousness, if you like, and we don't have a good word for it in everyday language. So we help people kind of recognize and utilize that part of themselves.
Some people call it the witness, or in psychoanalytic terms, the observing ego, I think, something like that.
Yeah, you know, the silent witness or the silent self. I actually think the best term for it is pure awareness. It's like the awareness of your own awareness. I can have a conversation with you. I can notice that I'm having a conversation with you, and I can notice that I'm noticing. It's like this part of me that is aware of my own awareness, or noticing my own noticing. Another good word for it is spacious awareness. There just isn't a good word in everyday language for it, and it plays an important part in mindfulness.
Okay.
So the other two processes, one is values, kind of clarifying your values, which you can think about as they're like your heart's deepest desires for how you want to behave as a human being. What are the qualities that you want to embody as a human being in this moment and the next moment and the moment afterwards? What do you want to stand for in life? A lot of time clarifying your values, and then committed action, which is where we actually translate those values into goals and into specific action. Let's take action guided by those values. And this is what we see, what we're aiming for in ACT is to help people live a rich, full, and meaningful life in which they can accept the pain that is an inevitable part of that life. So kind of by living by your values, taking action, meaningful, purposeful action, and using mindfulness to engage fully in what you're doing and to accept the inevitable pain of life rather than struggling with it or getting held down by it, that is what we see as the path to a rich, full, and meaningful life. We stay away from the word happiness because most people think happiness is feeling good, as I mentioned. And if you stop to consider it, you realize that things that make life rich, full, and meaningful don't just give you good feelings. Like, Dr. Dave, are you a parent?
Oh, four times over.
So you have four kids, and I'd imagine many of your listeners are parents too. So you think about having children. Children add a huge amount of meaning and purpose and fulfillment to your life, and they give you some of the most wonderful feelings you'll ever have, feelings of love and joy you didn't know were possible. But what other feelings do they give you?
Sometimes you want to thrash them. I shouldn't say that over the air.
Well, every parent knows you're speaking the truth, right? I mean, the rage, the anger, the guilt, the frustration, the anxiety, the tiredness, kids give you all sorts of painful emotions. And if you think about any kind of meaningful project in life, from marriage to having kids to building a business to getting a university degree, these kind of big meaningful projects that add richness and fullness to life give the full range of human emotions, not just the ones that feel good.
Yeah, and that makes a lot of sense. And actually, Martin Seligman, the guy who kicked off the whole happiness, positive psychology movement, has sort of backed off of the word happiness, I understand, and now he's talking more about thriving. And it sounds to me that sort of an approach would fit better with what you've just been describing.
Yeah, well, I mean, part of the reason I came up with the title The Happiness Trap was, partly because Martin Seligman's book, Authentic Happiness, the whole book was about how to feel happy. This was a landmark, multi-million copy bestseller.
Sure.
But in that whole book, Seligman's book on authentic happiness, there was not even half a page on accepting pain or the inevitability of painful feelings or how, the things that make life rich, full, and meaningful give rise to pain. So I haven't read his latest book, but I hope he has put something in there about the necessity of accepting pain. It's kind of great paradox that actually the greater your capacity to accept pain, the greater your capacity for kind of true lasting happiness, and the less your ability to accept the inevitable pain of life, the more prone you are to depression, anxiety, addiction, and a whole range of other psychological disorders. The technical term for this is something called experiential avoidance, which means the unwillingness to have painful thoughts and feelings. The higher level of experiential avoidance, the greater your risk of depression, developing PTSD after a trauma. I mean, the list just goes on and on and on. So one of the most useful things that we can teach people to do if they actually want to live happier lives is learn how to accept pain. Paradoxical stuff.
Yes, and I totally agree with you. You've got some interesting techniques in your book that help break these ideas down into, as I say, bite-sized pieces. One is one that you call musical thoughts, and another that you call naming the story. So maybe you could take us through those.
Yeah, so in diffusion, we're wanting people to learn to step back and see their thoughts for what they are, words and pictures in their head. Just a reminder that you know, there's no issue in ACT whether the thoughts are true or false. That's not what we're interested in. We're interested in is if you hold on tightly to the thoughts, if you get caught up in them, does it help you to do the things you want to do? Does it help you to be the person you want to be? So if I could just say a little bit more about that before I move on to musical thoughts, because
sure.
It's kind of fundamental to the whole ACT model. So, for example, a few years back, one of my clients was a massively overweight truck driver, and he kind of was just kept telling me how fat he was, and look at all his disgusting fat and so forth, and I kind of asked him, well, when you get all caught up in those thoughts, does it kind of help you to, look after your body or make healthy eating choices or, exercise? And he kind of said, well, no, but they're true. They're true. Look. And he kind of pulled his shirt up and showed me his, his gut hanging out. Thanks for sharing.
Yeah.
I said to him, look, one thing that is never going to happen in our sessions together is we're never going to get into a debate about whether your thoughts are true or not. The question I'm asking you is, when your mind starts telling you how fat you are, overweight you are, etc., if you get all caught up in those thoughts, does it actually help you be the person you want to be or do the things you want to do? Does it help you look after your body or exercise or eat well? And he long pause, and then he kind of said, well, no, it doesn't. It just made him feel guilty, and then because he didn't like feeling guilty, he'd start eating more food to try and distract himself from the guilt. So, this is kind of a big paradigm shift for most people. It's not about whether the thoughts are true or false. It's about if I hold on to them and let them push me around, does that help me do what I want to do? And so diffusion, we want to help people step back from their thoughts without getting into a debate or a dispute from them. So anything that helps you see the true nature of thoughts, helps you see them for what they are, they're kind of words or pictures or usually a combination of both that pop up into your head. Anything that helps you to see that, we can use for diffusion. So musical thoughts is a technique where we get people to sing their thoughts to a tune, like Happy Birthday or We Wish You a Merry Christmas. Having the thought, I'm incompetent, I might ask you to try singing that to the tune Happy Birthday. I am incompetent, I am incompetent. And it's very hard to take it seriously. Another variation on this is kind of say it in a silly voice. Kind of pick the voice of a cartoon character or a movie star or a sports commentator and try saying your thoughts in that voice.
I love these.
One of my clients, she had had a horrendously abusive mother growing up. Whenever she gained weight, her mother would say, you're fat, you're disgusting, no man will ever want to have sex with you. And whenever she lost weight, her mother would say, you're a slut, you're a whore, you just want to have sex with men. And this woman, by the time I saw her, she was a middle-aged woman. Her weight had fluctuated enormously throughout her life. And when she gained weight, she would hear one story, I'm fat and disgusting. When she lost weight, she'd hear the other story. She'd hear her thoughts in her mother's voice. And she'd been in therapy for years and years and years. She'd done all the kind of psychodynamic, psychoanalytic stuff, analyzed her childhood. She'd done traditional CBT, challenged and disputed these thoughts and looked at them in terms of true or false. She was still having lots of these thoughts. I mean, she knew where they came from and she knew they weren't true, but she was still very upset and distressed by them. So we had a look at this silly voice technique. And at the time I saw her, she was losing weight, so she was hearing my story about being a slut, etc. And I asked her to try playing these thoughts again. You can do it, most clients choose to do it in their own head rather than out aloud, but with quite extrovert people, you can get them to kind of do it out aloud. And certainly if you want to try around with this, if your readers, listeners want to try around with this at home, it's kind of fun to do it out aloud, although, you know, not at the family dinner table over dinner. So she chose to do it aloud, and the voice she picked was the voice of Brian's mother from the Monty Python film Life of Brian. And if your listeners have seen that film, it's a kind of comedy film.
Yes.
And Brian's mother has this squeaky, high-pitched voice, you know, he's not the Messiah, he's a naughty boy! Have you seen that film?
Yes, I have seen it, I have.
So she, one minute she's, you know, at the time I saw her, she was losing weight. She was hearing the kind of slut story. And she, you know, tears in her eyes, she's telling me this. And then I got her to try this technique. So she started saying it out aloud, you know, I'm a slut, I'm a whore, I just want to have sex with men, that's all I'm interested in. And
it does make it funny, right?
She just started cracking up laughing.
Yeah.
You know, this was a very powerful learning experience for her. So I kind of asked her, you know, between now and next session, when any time you kind of get hooked by these thoughts, the moment you realize it, see if you can unhook yourself, pick the thought that hooked you, and try saying it again in that voice.
It's wonderful that you can get her to, or you know, the person you're working with, to see the humor of it. Without mocking them, you're not mocking her. In a sense, she's mocking herself.
Absolutely, absolutely. And of course, you know, there's a timing issue there. You know, like, for example, if a client came in and they were in deep distress because their child had just been killed in a car crash, there's no way you would start doing this sort of work with them. You'd be working around a lot of self-compassion and making room for those painful emotions, mm-hmm. using expansion and so forth. To do something like this in that scenario would obviously be completely, you know, invalidating and unethical, you know, to do something like that. But when you pick the context and you use it in the right context and it comes from a space of compassion and validation, then it's very powerful for people.
Yes. Let me ask you about emotions. Often we refer to psychological problems as emotional problems. And we've been talking a lot about thoughts and how thoughts are just stories. What about emotions? What's the role of emotion in the ACT approach?
Well, what we teach people to do is kind of deconstruct their emotions, if you like. You know, there's this, let's suppose a strong emotion, overwhelming emotion shows up, fear or anxiety or something like that. What we help people do is kind of break it down and see the different elements. If we go with fear, for example, firstly, there's going to be kind of a story in your head about what's dangerous or what is the bad stuff that's going to happen, and we'll help you kind of notice those words. Often there'll be images in your head, too, about kind of, scary things happening, and we'll help you notice those images and those words. And then we'll have a look at what's happening in your body. You know, you probably notice sweaty hands, you'll probably notice a racing heart, you'll probably notice knots in your stomach or, you know, jelly in your legs. And we'll get you to notice each one of those different elements and see if you can cultivate this mindful awareness of it. If you have a look at those different experiences in your body with this kind of mental state of awareness and openness and curiosity, you find that your relationship with it changes. Instead of this this stuff in your body being so overwhelming or scary or horrible, you start to notice that it's actually just a bunch of sensations there.
Well, the sensations you just described sound like ones that come up around public speaking. And I know you do a lot of public speaking.
Yeah, well, look, you know, I'm very confident about public speaking, but that doesn't mean an absence of fear and anxiety. When I speak in public, I have lots of anxiety. My heart races, my hands drip with sweat. You know, this is one of the popular, it's another kind of misleading idea that confidence is an absence of fear. But what I do is I accept those feelings. Public speaking, the stuff that I talk about is very important to me. It's an important, meaningful part of my life. And so I'm willing to make room for the sensations that arise in my body when I do that. I recently was on stage with one of Australia's best-known public speakers, a guy called Alan Pease, who's been, you know, a professional speaker for 40 years. And I said to him, you know, Alan, you've been doing this for, you know, most of your life. Do you still feel anxious when you kind of talk in public? And he said, I still get the butterflies in my stomach, but now I've trained them to fly in formation.
That's great.
Yeah. And, you know, and I think that's a good way of saying it. You know, if I have those sensations in my body, but I'm not fighting or struggling with them in any way, then they lose their impact and influence over me. Then I can put my energy into my talk. And indeed, all top stage performers know this. You know, if you talk to a rock star or an actor, you know, before they go on stage, they're going to be feeling a fight or flight response, this kind of racing heart and, you know, knots in the stomach and all this kind of stuff, which is what humans feel when they face a challenge. When you step out of your comfort zone into a challenging situation, you have a fight or flight response. But if you talk to these performers, they're not likely to use the word anxiety or fear to describe it. They'll probably describe it as an adrenaline rush or being revved or amped or buzzed, something like that.
Mm-hmm. Earlier you used the word struggle, and I know in the book you mentioned something you call the struggle switch in relation to emotions. What's the struggle switch?
Well, it's kind of, so we live in a feel-good society. Everyone likes to feel good and no one likes to feel bad. And so what happens is we develop a sort of struggle switch at the back of our mind. As soon as an unpleasant emotion shows up, the struggle switch goes on. So let's talk this through with anxiety, as it's something that we all experience repeatedly in our lives. Anxiety shows up, the struggle switch goes on. Oh no, here's anxiety. I don't like these feelings in my body. Why am I feeling this way? How do I get rid of them? Well, now I've got anxiety about my anxiety. Oh no, it's getting worse. More anxiety. Oh, how do I make this? Well, it's getting even bigger still.
Yeah.
Then, with the struggle switch stays on, then maybe I get angry about my anxiety. Why does this keep happening to me? Now I've got anger about my anxiety. Then I may get sad about it. Oh God, is this my life? Is this what I, you know, now I've got sadness about my anger, about my anxiety, about my anxiety. So the struggle switch is like an emotional amplifier. It makes our emotions get bigger and bigger and bigger and messier and more painful.
Uh-huh.
But if I can, you know, and if we come back to the idea of stage performers, from time to time you see this happen. The stage performer starts struggling with that fight or flight response. Oh no, I can't go out on stage while I've got this knot in my stomach or this tightness in my chest. I can't go out on stage until it's gone away. And now it's turned into stage fright. It's exactly the same experience, a fight or flight response in a challenging situation, but my attitude towards it determines whether I'm revved or amped or buzzed or whether I've got stage fright.
Now, you come out of a background of CBT, you told us, and I know self-talk plays a role in that. What's the role of self-talk in ACT?
Well, not huge. The sort of self-talk in ACT is really reminding yourself what your values are. What do I want to stand for in the face of this challenge? What do I want to stand for in the face of this situation? What really matters to me deep inside? So let's suppose I am going to give a talk in public and I am feeling really anxious. The self-talk might just be, why am I doing this? What matters enough that I'm willing to put myself in this scary situation? What am I going to stand for as I do this? Not really very much at all. It's really just as a reminder that my actions are linked to something important and meaningful. If they're not linked to something important and meaningful, why am I bothering? Why am I doing this unless there's something meaningful or important to it?
Uh-huh. Now, what about the role of imagery in ACT?
Well, we use imagery in lots of different ways. We often use imagery to facilitate acceptance. Like if there's a painful feeling in my body, I might ask you to mentally draw an outline around it. How big is it? Is it at the surface? Is it in the middle? And then give it a shape and a color and a texture and so forth. And, you know, it's quite interesting that often as you turn this feeling in your body into a sort of object, it often facilitates a sense of acceptance. Often it gets much easier to have it there. because normally I'm just in this state of overwhelm. Oh God, here's this feeling, I can't handle it. But as I start to see, you know, there's a big ball in my stomach or there's a plank on my chest, I kind of realize, okay, well, yeah, there's this happening in my body and this is just one aspect of what's happening in this moment. There's a plank in my chest and there's a ball in my stomach and there's my arms and my legs here and there's everything that I can see and hear and touch and taste and smell. You know, there's a whole lot going on in this moment. I don't have to give all my attention to this ball in my stomach or this plank in my chest.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I'm trained as a psychotherapist too, so I like to get personal with people. Are there ways in which ACT and the techniques you've been describing have been helpful in your own personal growth or maybe in dealing with some of the issues or stuck points in your own life?
Oh, look, yeah, massively, massively. I mean, you know, my little boy, Max, at the age of 2, was diagnosed with autism. And I didn't know it was possible to feel so much pain, mm-hmm. you know, as the pain was just so excruciating. My world just crumbled, and this model really helped me get through it. It helped me kind of accept my pain. We often ask the question in ACT: what would you have to not care about in order to not have these painful feelings? You know, as a parent, to not feel pain when your kid gets diagnosed, you'd have to kind of not care about them at all. Love and pain are intimate dance partners. And so kind of just recognizing, of course, I've got these feelings of sadness and fear, and this just goes along with being a loving, caring parent. And then asking myself, you know, what do I want to stand for in the face of this challenge? What sort of parent do I want to be? And kind of getting in touch with those values around being loving and caring and compassionate and supportive kind of gave me the energy to, you know, take the action necessary to help this little kid get all the possible help he could. Very easy to get caught up in, in the early days, taking him to playgrounds or around other parents, and just my mind would just start comparing him to the other kids and looking at all the ways in which the other kids were doing so much better and developing so much faster than him, and that would kind of pull me into a dark space. And the problem was that then I was missing out on recognizing my kid and appreciating all the little things that he was doing in his way and all the little ways that he was growing, although not as fast as the other kids. So mindfulness helped me to kind of unhook from those thoughts and come back and be present and appreciate him for who he is and appreciate him for the gains that he made.
Yes, and as you were saying earlier, as much as we want to avoid pain and try to flee it, if we're able to meet those challenges with the kind of attitude that you've been describing, real growth can happen. And I would imagine that you've grown as a person from, in a way, the challenges in a certain way have maybe been a gift in your life.
Yeah, I mean, enormously so. I mean, you know, give me an alternative reality where I had a kid that was normal. It would have been very, very different. I'd choose the alternative, but given that you don't have that choice, you know, we often say in ACT, you don't get to choose the deck of cards you've been dealt. You just get to choose how you play with them. So, you know, I played with those cards, and we got Max the best possible treatment. And in fact, you know, this story has an incredibly happy ending. By the time Max was 4.5, he'd improved so much that he no longer meets criteria for autism.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Oh, it's amazing. You know, if you saw this little boy now, he's 5.5 now, if you saw him running around, chatting, laughing, playing with the other kids at school, you would never believe that this kid at age 2 could not walk, could not talk, did not know his own name. It's a miracle. So, you know, I was very lucky in that sense. That's an uncommon story. But, all parents are, and look, if you kind of invest in any area of life, whether relationships that make life so meaningful, you're going to encounter pain and hurt. You don't get love without pain.
That's
and,
right.
Yeah.
Well, we should probably wrap it up here. I wonder if there, other than other than buy my book, are there any final thoughts that you'd like to leave our listeners with?
I'll just leave you with the final sentence of the book, which is, life gives most to those who make the most of what life gives.
Well, that's a great wrap-up thought. Dr. Russ Harris, I want to thank you for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me. It was a lot of fun.
I hope you enjoyed this interview with Dr. Russ Harris. I really like the way he has framed the ACT approach in his book. As you heard me say, I was very impressed by Stephen Hayes, the originator of ACT, back when I interviewed him on my other show at Wise Counsel Podcast way back in March of 2007. And at that time, I was impressed to learn that Dr. Hayes had been developing and researching his acceptance commitment therapy for more than 30 years. Not only did it seem to have a solid research foundation, but it also ties together the best elements of Eastern mindfulness practices with Western behavioral thought. Russ's book repackages the theory in a very readable, down-to-earth manner. I think his Happiness Trap title was deliberately provocative and a good marketing strategy given all the interest and happiness generated by the positive psychology movement. My own opinion is that it sets up positive psychology as a kind of straw man, however, because I've interviewed a number of people from that orientation, and none of them would deny that life is full of inevitable ups and downs. In fact, I don't think they would find anything to quarrel with in Russ's book. In truth, I think his book is very much about the quest for happiness, if happiness is defined as a satisfying and meaningful life. I'm happy to recommend The Happiness Trap as an excellent self-help book, as well as one that many therapists might want to assign their clients or use for their own inspiration.
You're on the couch again with Dr. Dave. And Shrink Wrap Radio is playing on again. Yeah. It's all in your head. It's all in your head. Shrink Wrap Radio. Shrink Wrap Radio. Shrink Wrap Radio. Shrink Wrap Radio.
It's Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head.
Well, hello, everybody. Once again, it's a Friday, and I'm still trying to stick to this schedule for a while of putting a show out each and every Friday because I'm kind of backed up with guests, people that I've already interviewed. And it just doesn't seem fair to keep them waiting so long. So I'm putting these shows out on a somewhat more frequent basis. Now, I'm just back from the International Positive Psychology Association Second World Conference that was in Philadelphia. And you may hear it in my voice that I picked up a cold there. So so my voice is a little scratchy. And I have a lot of great ideas and content from this IPPA convention and potential guests, people that I heard there, as well as a number of short interviews that I did on the floor, as well as the keynote address by Martin Seligman, which he has given me permission to use, and a couple of other keynotes that I might want to use. I have to get permission first. So, boy, we're going to have a lot of stuff on positive psychology probably here for a while. I had about 1,000 postcard size cardstock flyers printed up and that I took with me, and I ended up distributing about 400 of them. So if you're listening to this podcast as a result of having received one of those calls, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio, and thanks so much for taking advantage of that bit of PR that I put out there. It's a bit ironic that on the heels of the Positive Psychology World Congress, that this particular interview was about a book called The Happiness Trap. As I think I said in my comments, I think that was a bit of a straw man. As a matter of fact, there was mention of acceptance commitment therapy a couple of times in this Positive Psychology conference. In fact, one of the things that really became clear to me is the degree to which positive psychology is much more nuanced than maybe comes across in some of the popular books. And this is probably because it is, as it matures, so many different lines of research and personalities sort of want to get their nose under the tent of this movement. So it's not just about happiness, but it's also about love, it's about passion, it's about mindfulness, it's about coaching, it's about neuroscience, about compassion, about behavioral economics, about resilience, and much, much more. In fact, there were 1,200 people from 66 countries in attendance at this conference. And it was good for me to be back in Philadelphia because I was an undergraduate at the University of Pennsylvania many, many years ago. And so the city has changed radically. The campus has expanded greatly. My son Matthew hopped on a bus from Manhattan, where he lives now, to join me for a day there. And so we had a wonderful time together. So let's see, what else can I tell you? You know, on my other podcast series, wisecounselpodcast.com, the interview with Kristen Neff, Dr. Kristen Neff of University of Texas at Austin, about her book on self-compassion. And of course, you'll remember that she is the mother of the horse boy. So be sure to check that one out if you haven't had a chance to do so yet. And don't forget to go to shrinkwrapradio.com. And in the right-hand sidebar, you'll see that big green donate button. And please do donate. I'm happy to report that while I was away, we picked up a few new donors, I think two or three, who committed for monthly donations for a year on PayPal. And I can't tell you how much I appreciate that. And at the same time, the total number of donors is infinitesimal compared to the number of listeners to these podcasts. And of course, you know, so much work goes into them. And while it's a little difficult to blow my own horn and plead for money here, when it comes right down to it, I think I'd rather promote Shrink Wrap Radio, which is my passion, than to pump for commercial sponsors or to lock the content behind a barrier, as some other, you know, behind a virtual barrier, as some other podcasters are doing to, quote, monetize their podcasts. So thank you for your donations. Keep them coming. Let's get some more people on board. I thank you all very much.
Hi, this is Dr. Ofer Zur, forensic psychologist and director of the Zur Institute. And you are on a couch with Dr. Dave.
Yes, my good friend Dr. Ofer Zur will be next week's guest, and I'll say more about that at the end of today's show. So let's catch up on a bit of back email. First, we hear from Louise, who writes in response to my thanking her for her donation. Dear Dr. Dave, all I can say is that my donation is long overdue. I listen and re-listen to your podcasts almost daily. Wow. I can only echo the sentiments of the people whose emails you've read, the positive ones, of course. Have a great and positive conference trip, and thanks again for all that you do. Cheers, Louise. And Louise, thank you so much for being a longtime listener, I believe, and such a faithful and dedicated one. I really appreciate your support. In a similar vein, Andy Hunt also writes in response to my thanking him for his donation. He writes, "Hi, Dave, thanks. We should be writing to you to say how much we appreciate you for all your work. All the best, Andy." And again, that's Andy Hunt, and he's been a longtime listener as well. And another longtime listener, Paul Salvatore up in Canada, wrote to say how much he appreciated the interview with Robert Biswas-Diener, the Indiana Jones of positive psychology. And by the way, I got to hear Robert's father, Ed Diener. He gave an amazing presentation, and maybe I'll get to play that on the show. So, Paul, you'll be pleased to know that I got to meet Robert in person at the IPPA conference, and also his sidekick, Rocco Bellick, who I interviewed here, and whose movie Happy is currently making the rounds in major cities around the country. Two very cool guys. Finally, let me close with one from Oksana in the UK, who writes the gratitude blog that I mentioned on the last show. And Oksana writes, "Dear Dr. Dave, thank you very much for leaving a kind comment on my gratitude blog. That really made my day. Your show was one of the inspirations for this blog, as I mentioned on the About page in that particular episode about Awakening Joy, number 239. Gratitude was one of the methods mentioned. In the gratitude blog, I do not disclose my identity so that readers just see the gratitude and not so much the person. My name is Oksana, and I won't try to pronounce her last name. It's very Russian-sounding. She says, I live in the northwest of England. I have a PhD from the University of Manchester in politics. At the moment, I write, paint, and perform. Wow, what a diverse life. Your podcast is one of my favorites. I listen to each week. I love the broad range of topics, the depth of research, and the sincerity of conversations. I especially enjoy episodes related to any aspect of the Buddha's Dharma, as I am a practitioner of Buddhist meditation and creativity, as I am an artist. I'm also a feminist. I'm not into male bashing, though. I always say that men can't like the male world they live in, where absolute majority of prison population are men, and where they die in vastly larger numbers than women in wars, in fights, from substance abuse, and generally from stress this male world brings them. I have to agree with that. She goes on to say, I believe that exploring and bringing forth the feminine in women and in men and the world benefits all. In this light, I would like to thank you for interviewing some very interesting women and also for producing excellent episodes of your podcast exclusively dedicated to female issues. And she lists number 203, The Feminine Face of God with Sherry Ruth Anderson, number 186, What Happy Women Know with Kathy Greenberg, number 101, The Bitch, the Crone, and the Harlot, and number 85, The Heroine's Journey with Maureen Murdoch. She goes on to say, I know that you already do a lot and that you've got other important topics to cover. I would just like to express my personal wish for more Shrink Wrap Radio podcasts dedicated to women and the feminine. And you can read this email in full or in parts on your podcast, which I have just done. And she concludes, thank you very much. Yours sincerely, Oksana. And if you'd like to check out her, well, she's got a webpage, which you can find at http://poeticoksana.wordpress.com. So I hope you can find her. She's definitely worth checking out. So with that, I think we better wrap it up for today. As always, you can send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. You can leave comments about individual shows in the comments area on the site. You can leave voicemails on Skype, where I'm ShrinkPod, and you can leave voicemail on my phone at 206-337-0622. Thanks to Dr. Russ Harris for sharing his work utilizing acceptance commitment therapy. As you heard earlier, my guest on the next episode will be Dr. Ofer Zur. Dr. Zur is a very prolific psychologist from my own local area here. And as you know, he's made it possible for me to offer you CE credits for listening to shows on dreams and on positive psychology through his online Zur Institute. And you can find links to that on the shrinkwrapradio.com site. As a result of this contact, we've become friends. In the upcoming episode, he'll be speaking about his experiences and views in relation to trauma and PTSD. I hope you'll join us. Until then, this is Dr. Dave saying, It's all in your mind.